So, in the early 1880s, Leopold could turn a land spanning as much as 900,000 square miles, that is 87 times the size of Belgium, into personal property. Although the Belgian government made extensive efforts to conceal its crimes in the Congo and even destroyed certain documents and reports, the articles that were published years later by Western journalists about that era revealed that as many as half of the Congo's population had been killed during Leopold's 40-year rule, which amounts to a massacre of tens of millions of people. The days of independence dawned after years of fighting by the people of the Congo. During the battle, the voice that was more vociferous than those of others belonged to a good-looking, determined young man named Patrice Lumumba. He wanted to obliterate the legacy of Leopold, which continued to haunt his country. Lumumba was imprisoned for his anti-colonialism activities for a while, but he was elected as leader of the Congolese National Movement in 1958. A movement led by the young Lumumba, which managed to overcome ethnic and tribal differences and revive the spirit of national unity and independence seeking among millions of the Congolese people. The first coup plot in the Congo was hatched with the help of the U.S. Western allies. The state of Katanga was a rich mining region in the Congo, which had large deposits of copper, cobalt, uranium, and gold. Moise Tshombe, an old friend of Western multinational corporations, was the president of the state. Katanga proclaimed its independence and secession from the Congo only 11 days after the country's independence and staged rebellion against the central government and Prime Minister Lumumba himself. It is worth mentioning that as much as Moise Tshombe was pro-Western, he had a strange grudge against Lumumba. After Lumumba was disappointed about receiving any aid from the U.S., he had no choice but to appeal to the East superpower. Unlike the U.S., the Soviets welcomed the Congo government this time. Now they could pin the label of communist on Lumumba and his government. The Americans used this weapon in the best possible way. As the Congo was engulfed in chaos, Congolese President Joseph Kasavubu removed Lumumba from power in a dismissal order on September the 5th, just 74 days after the central government had taken office, a decision that the Prime Minister refused to accept. Lumumba went to the parliament and tried to dismiss President Kasavubu. He delivered such a fervent and reasonable speech that both the Senate and the National Assembly voted in favor of Lumumba. Under such circumstances, the Prime Minister needed to win the global public opinion, so he held a news conference with international journalists to inform the world of his stances. But some of these newspapers described him as Africa's Lenin. The Americans did not stand idle either. Since 1959, they had established a solid and reliable relation with a Congolese army officer called General Joseph Mobutu.
Joseph Mobutu.
Mobutu, who served as chief of staff of the army during the 1960 crisis, had been in constant contact with the CIA station chief in the Congo, Lawrence Devlin, all throughout the crisis. Relations between Mobutu and the CIA worked out well for them. Eventually, and just after 2 months, Joseph Mobutu staged a coup against Lumumba on September 14, 1960, and ousted his government, which was the first democratically elected one in the Congo's history. Meanwhile, the U.S. refused to issue a visa for Lumumba to attend the UN session to prevent him from addressing the world directly. Now, the Congo had two governments which both sought recognition from the UN. Surprisingly enough, Sweden's Dag Hammarskjöld, the then UN Secretary General, recognized the coup government of Joseph Mobutu. The Prime Minister's situation was getting worse day by day. Lumumba's house was besieged by UN forces. The UN forces did not even allow him to speak on the radio under the pretext that Lumumba's remarks would aggravate the crisis and would further increase tensions. The communication between the head of Congo's democratically elected government and the people was cut off. Finally, Lumumba managed to escape the UN besiege and headed with his family to the city of Stanleyville, located 2,000 kilometers north of the capital, where Lumumba's supporters were seeking to form a government alongside the coup government. Patrice Lumumba delivered speeches to the people in most of the cities and villages in his escape to the north to inform them about the facts behind the developments in the Congo. CIA agents followed Lumumba all throughout the way. They were looking for a suitable place where the coup army could arrest him. On December the 1st, 1960, as the Prime Minister was crossing the Sankuru River with his family, the spies announced that the time was ripe for his arrest. As Lumumba's boat approached the shore, forces loyal to the coup leader Mobutu got into the boat. Lumumba was taken to the capital aboard a plane, but those who accompanied him forgot that he was the prime minister until just a few days ago. Patrice Lumumba arrived at the airport of Leopold, which was full of reporters. They showed the prime minister to the public in a very humiliating and offensive way, a move which was planned to tarnish his charismatic image. His wife and children were witnesses to what was happening at the airport some meters away. Lumumba, along with two of his cabinet ministers, Maurice Ampolo and Joseph Okito, were sent to the state of Katanga to be executed. Moise Tshombe, Lumumba's archenemy, was looking forward to receiving his guest. On June 17, 1961, the Katanga government, led by Moise Tshombe and supported by Belgian advisors, decided that Patrice Lumumba and his two accompanying ministers should be executed. At around 8:30 p.m., the prisoners were taken to a place in the depth of a remote forest to be executed.
Lumumba
Moses Tshombe was present in the place along with his ministers. The soldiers shot Lumumba and his companions dead and then rolled their bodies into a ditch. The coup government spread a rumor in an attempt to answer to the public opinion. The rumor was that Lumumba had escaped in a stolen car and was later arrested and killed by local people. However, the people of the Congo never believed this official account of the incident. The true story about the abduction and execution of Lumumba was leaked after several years. But Lumumba's body could also be highly problematic. He was so popular that the discovery of his body could put his murderers into trouble. Therefore, they decided to exhume and destroy the bodies. The mission was delegated to a Belgian officer called Gerard Sauté. They returned to the place where the bodies had been buried. They exhumed the bodies, and after drinking a lot of alcohol, they dismembered the bodies and dissolved them in sulfuric acid. After years of conflict and civil war, Joseph Mobutu wrested full control over the Congo in 1965. After that, Mobutu, who called himself Mobutu Sese Seko, ruled over the Congo for 32 years with an iron fist. He even changed the name of the Congo to Zaire. With Mobutu's seizing of power, the U.S. had found a puppet government in the heart of the strategic continent of Africa for three decades.
Well, Zaire is among America's oldest friends, and its president, President Mobutu, one of our most valued friends. The entire continent of Africa. We are proud and very, very pleased to have you with us today. Thank you, sir.
Mobutu was one of the world's wealthiest men until 1997, with a fortune estimated as much as $5 billion, while the Congo's population of 40 million had been degraded to one of the world's poorest nations. Mobutu was ousted from power in 1997 by Laurent Kabila, a leader of one of the main rebel groups. He later died of cancer in Morocco. During the civil wars that ensued Mobutu's fall, some 5.5 million of the Congolese people were killed, while millions of others were displaced. Nine African countries and 20 militia groups were involved in the wars, which are remembered as the African World War. Civil war, violence, disease, hunger, and poverty were the legacy of the colonialist rule of Belgian King Leopold II, as well as the involvement of the White House rulers in overthrowing the only democratically elected and popular government in this green land. Although in 2002, the Belgian government apologized to the Congolese people for the involvement of its forces in deposing and killing Patrice Lumumba, the U.S. government has yet to apologize for architecting and launching the Congo coup and contributing to Patrice Lumumba's assassination.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim. Deen al-Islam, deen al-Islam, deen al-Islam.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We are going to talk about the laws related to Amr Ma'ruf and Nahy an Munkar, which is the concept of enjoying the good and forbidding the evil, according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography. A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, we testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
SubhanAllah.
back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Mohammad Javad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are talking about the concept of enjoining the good and forbidding the evil and the jurisprudential statuses, according to Ayatollah Khamenei, about that with Sheikh Javid. Sheikh Javid, you know, in the last episode, we actually promised our dear audience to talk about the conditions for enjoining the good and forbidding the evil. After you clarified and kindly elaborated on the very concept of enjoining the good and forbidding the evil, and whether it is obligatory or not, that you mentioned that it is obligatory as far as the knowledge is concerned, right?
Sure.
So would you please tell our audience about the conditions? What are the conditions for Amr bil Ma'ruf and Nahy anil Munkar?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, Amr bil Ma'ruf wa Nahy anil Munkar, which is translated as enjoining the good and forbidding the evil, or promoting virtue and preventing evil, is without a doubt obligatory when a person sees that felonies are committed, mm-hmm. Offenses are being committed, and evil is being spread by someone. Then it is necessary and quite obligatory for according to Islamic Sharia, for that individual to take action to stop that evil and to prevent that evil from spreading. And it's the duty of every duty-bound person, every individual who has attained the legal age, the age of legal responsibility. But of course, as I mentioned, the person who enjoins must know the obligatory and haram act, and this is the first condition. Mm-hmm. Okay, having knowledge of the obligatory and haram acts is the first obligation. If you do not know what is haram and what's halal, how can you stop it?
How can you tell the difference?
How can you tell the difference? How can you enjoin others mm-hmm. to do good?
Yes.
So one must have proper knowledge of halal and haram, and he should have knowledge of the Islamic Sharia and the Islamic law. Otherwise, he's not obliged to enjoin others. So if one, for example, does not consider an action as haram or obligatory due to ijtihad or taqlid, for example,
right?
Yeah, because there are we see that there are some, for example, mujtahids who because of their who because of ijtihad or because of taqlid does not believe that something is haram. For example, mm-hmm. According to Supreme Leader Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, smoking cigarette is forbidden as an obligatory precaution if it causes substantial damage. Okay. Mm-hmm. But there is precaution. His right. Eminence exercises precaution. I know of some religious authorities who believe that smoking is forbidden. Mm-hmm. There is no precaution.
I see.
So one has to know, one has to know whether something is haram or halal according to Islamic Sharia and according to the religious authority who he follows. Otherwise, it's not obligatory. So, for example, when it comes to some actions being considered haram or obligatory due to, for example, ijtihad or taqlid, it's not obligatory for another person who considers it obligatory or haram to enjoin that individual.
Yes.
Because he is acting
but
according to
how
his...
How do they know that, for example, this individual is following another religious authority and then you don't know?
For example, come across such individual, you can either ask him or you probably must know it, if you don't know.
Sometimes it's a personal issue, Sheikh Javid, and they don't want to express clearly
right.
that they are following, for example, a certain marja, right?
Yes.
So, and it is not incumbent on you to ask other people.
Yeah,
so,
it's not incumbent.
And
okay.
It's not necessary for them to answer you. Right? It's too personal,
yeah,
isn't it?
It is personal. You're right. As long as the issue is clearly defined, for example, no one from any religious authorities considers, for example, drinking alcohol alcoholic intoxicating beverages halal, okay?
Right.
And no one considers dogs or pigs pure, okay?
Sure.
So these are clearly defined Sharia laws. And when it comes to such things, there's no room for any doubt.
I see.
Okay.
You
can right away, you know, forbid him. You can just start telling him off not to, for example, approach impurity,
okay.
Not to commit such.
Okay.
Now, that was the first condition.
Yes. Thank you very much. Let's take a short break and we'll be back to further our discussion. Stay with us.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Jawad, his host in this program, and Sheikh Javed, our guest speaker. We are talking about the concept and the conditions of enjoining the good and forbidding the evil according to Ayatollah Khamenei. Sheikh Javed, you've are through with the first condition.
Yeah.
And what is the second condition?
The second condition is probability of being effective.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you enjoin someone to do good and
right.
forbid from evil, there should be likelihood of that enjoining to be effective.
Mm-hmm.
And when one thinks that, for example, enjoining can be effective, even in the future, let's say, it is obligatory for him to do so, even if there is a strong possibility that it will not be effective, okay? But there is likelihood, there is some kind of possibility that enjoining could be effective.
Mm-hmm.
If there is a chance or likelihood of that, of your words being effective, because there are stages
mm-hmm.
in Amr bil Ma'ruf wa Nahy al Munkar. For example, if any of the stage is going to be effective, it is going to help that individual, for example, do something good,
yes.
or stop, refrain from doing something bad,
yes.
then that becomes obligatory.
Uh-huh.
And of course, if enjoining another person to do an obligatory act or from doing or forbid from refrain from doing something haram, is not sufficient by a single person. No, one person is not sufficient. There
right.
should be a group of people or
mm-hmm.
many people
yes.
to enjoin. Then it becomes necessary for
right.
for all those people, all
mm-hmm.
those people to join together
yes.
and forbid that person from doing haram thing, or enjoin him to do good things. You know, because the one person may not be as effective as two people. So two people, three people, the more the number of the people, the more effective it is going to be. In that case, all those people have to join together and forbid. And then there's a third condition, to insist on the sin, you know. Sometimes you might commit a haram act, you know, only once for all, you know, once
yes.
forever. And you are not actually planning, you're not intending to commit that act again and again.
It's a random act.
Yeah, so it happens randomly. So if a person is bent on doing something again and again,
uh-huh.
then it becomes necessary to forbid that individual.
Uh-huh.
The sinner, according to Supreme Leader, insists on the continuation of the sin. You know? So if it is, for example, known or even probable that he will give up the error without being enjoined,
uh-huh.
then, of course, it is not obligatory for you to enjoin him,
uh-huh.
you know, if
I
it
see.
Is probable.
Okay.
That, okay, because he is not intending to
yeah.
to commit it again and again.
And it's not a systematic act of evil.
You're right.
Or evilness. Thank you very much. Is that all?
There's one thing. You know, no vile consequences,
uh-huh.
No negative consequences. You know, enjoining good is okay, it's obligatory. Forbidding evil is necessary. But it should not have a negative effect. Let's say there should not be any danger threatening you. There should not be any, you know, any negative results. For example, if it's feared that you might be attacked by that individual,
or hurt.
You'll get hurt, or maybe your reputation will be damaged, or your money, you lose your money.
I see.
In that case, it's no longer obligatory.
Obligatory. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid, for your nice contribution to this program, Islamic Laws, on IRIB English Radio. We were talking about the conditions for enjoining the good and forbidding the evil to be obligatory, according to Ayatollah Khamenei. Thank you very much for listening to this program. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
Join us in this journey, IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we will listen to the speech of Sheikh Osama Abdul Ghani.
Today, brothers and sisters, inshallah, we're going to be addressing a very, very important spiritual disease. So, the disease you and I are going to talk about is one which is called in Arabic, Su'udhan. It's when we think badly of others. So now I want to give you a little bit of a case study for us to think about. In this first case study, brothers and sisters, there's a family, and the first thing that comes to their mind when anything happens, so this is inside a family, husband, wife, children, whenever anybody does anything in the first family, the assumption is the worst. There's always an angle. What are you trying to do? What did you mean by that? Imagine one family that's like that. We're going to talk about how that even if you're trying to repair a relationship, we'll talk about that later, that the imam explains that this stops us from being able to repair a relationship. Because now even if you do something kind, imagine a family like this. We're always on guard, always looking. What is it you're trying to do? What is your angle? Now we're trying to fix the relationship. The person wants to do something nice to me. Now I'm like, why? Hadith. We'll talk about that inshallah later. So that's the first family. The second family is one where the assumption is always the person was trying to do the right thing. The person comes in a little late from work. The wife would assume, must be working long hours. My husband's such a hero. My wife didn't help. This is inside our family. My wife didn't do the laundry. There's one time, the first family, she's trying to teach me a lesson. I'll show. Isn't it? Maybe she forgot. Every time there's a situation, it's a chance for more love with this first, the second family, right? So obviously, those two families, the experience they have in life is going to be very different. What the imam tells us, the next hadith, is that if you think good of people, this actually creates love. People love those who think good about them. Right? Or as opposed to those who are, you have to always, everything you say, you have to, what does the person mean? What are they trying to say? Hadith says this, man hasuna dhannahu bin nas. The person who thinks good of others, haza minhum al-mahabba. This person, Imam Ali says, he gets the love of others. If you think about it, this is what those who love one another do. If you really care about somebody, if you like someone, if you think that that person's a good person, when a mistake happens, you automatically assume that they're trying to do the right thing. There was a man named Shaqiq. Shaqiq. And Shaqiq says, one year I went to make Hajj. He says, when I went to make Hajj, you know, there in the good old days, back in the old days, there were areas where you would stop in and then you would travel along the way to Hajj. So he says, I went to one of these rest stops where everybody was, everybody's dressed up, everybody's getting ready for Hajj. And he said, I saw one youth who was very handsome. Obviously, face full of nur. This person, he mentions, he was brown, very handsome. He says, thin. And he was off in the distance from everybody else. So everybody's getting ready to move to Hajj. This person is sitting off in the distance. And he says he was wearing a woolen cloak. A woolen cloak. In my mind, Shaqiq says, in my mind, when I saw this person, I said to myself, this person is definitely a Sufi. He wants to go to Hajj, and he wants to be a burden on all the other Hujjaj. He thinks he's so pious, he's worshiping, he's going to be over here, he's going to go in the caravan, and he's not going to do his responsibility. He's going to be busy with work because he's avoiding everybody. He has so much nur in his face. This person has a problem. He said, in my mind, I made a decision to go over and to warn him about this terrible behavior. And he said, I went over to him, and when I went over to him, then he turned to me without me saying anything. So I'm walking to this youth who I see off in the distance. Without me saying anything, he turned to me and he said, Shaqiq, ijtanibu kathiran min adhan, inna ba'd adhan ith. Shaqiq, he called me by my own name. He said, avoid much suspicion. Surely some suspicion is sin. He said, when he called me by my name, I said, oh, this is somebody a little bit different. He just read my mind. He said the appropriate verse. I didn't even get up to him. I just thought something. He said, this is one of Allah's awliya. He said, I wanted to walk up to him, but he got up, he left. I didn't see him. He disappeared amongst the crowd. He said, so we continued, and as they were going towards Hajj, there were different places that they would stop. At another one of these rest stops, he saw this person, and He saw him over there in a corner praying. This same special person, the Nurani, he saw them over there in a corner praying. And he says, the prayer of this person, limbs shivering out of fear of Allah, crying tears. He said, I thought badly of him. I want to ask for forgiveness. He said, I started going over to get to the person to ask for forgiveness. Why is it I thought badly of you? And there, before I got a chance to speak, again, he told me, Shaheed. He said, he quoted a verse, وَإِنِّي لَغَفَارٌ لِمَنْ تَابَ وَآمَنَ وَعَمِلَ صَالِحًا ثُمَّ اهْتَدَى. He quoted another verse of the Quran, that I certainly am forgiving of the person who makes tawbah and has faith, iman, and does good deeds, and then is guided. He quoted another verse of Quran. So, been forgiven. And then again, I don't catch up to him, he leaves. He says, so, we continue on the trip to Hajj. He says, we come to another rest stop. And in this rest stop, I see him off in the distance. And what happens is, I'm looking at this youth. He's off in the distance. And what happens is, he's by a well. And he has a bucket. And he's trying to get water, to bring water up from the well. And when the bucket slips out of his hand, it goes down into the water. He looks up at heaven. And then he starts addressing Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, that you are my Lord. When I'm thirsty, you provide me with water. When I'm hungry, you provide me with food. Oh Allah, I don't have anything other than this bucket. Please bring this bucket back for me. Don't take this bucket. He said, don't take this bucket away from me. He said, and then I saw with my own two eyes, the water in the well rose until the bucket came up. The person took the bucket, made wudu. So he's like, who is this? One of Allah's awliya. Again, he wasn't. Later on, he sees this person. Now when he sees the person, he's at the Kaaba. He's at the Kaaba, crying. He describes how the person is. He says, and now when the person leaves the Kaaba, I notice there's people walking with him, people trying to say salams to him, perhaps getting tabarruk from him. I ask, who is that person? They said, that's Musa ibn Ja'far. Imam Musa ibn Ja'far. So what happens is, if thinking badly of others is not kept under control, it can get to the stage where I might assume something bad about someone who's excellent, even an imam. So this gives us a little bit of an idea of how serious this is. Inshallah, later on, if Allah gives tawfiq, we'll try and talk a little bit about some solutions and how to make sure that we don't have this trait.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Azim Alimun Halim Hakimun Mateen.
Yani
Bazaar.
The need for home appliances dates back to the early stages of human existence, when cave dwellers began developing tools to preserve and prepare food. Today, home technology has become more sophisticated to match our fast-paced lifestyles. The level of convenience and comfort of home is also determined by these items, and they have even become a status symbol for some. In a sense, home appliances define modern living, changing the means of dealing with food, clothing, cleaning, and so much more. Hello there, and welcome to another edition of Bazaar. I'm Samson Seas, back from the Seven Seas. It's great to be back. This week, we're going to dive into the world of home appliance production. We want to see who the major players are in this industry and see how the market is doing. We will also uncover some of the major contributions of the home appliance industry to the country's economy as a whole. So, let's check it out. Our journey this time took us to Abbasabad Industrial City on the outskirts of the capital Tehran. There, we visited a company that specializes in the production of home appliances. Emerson was established some 40 years ago and has become a household name in this industry. In the early days of its activity, it started out by making freezers. Over the years, it has expanded its product list and now manufactures refrigerators, cookers, and washing machines, among a long list of other items. This company has expansive production halls, which house its chain production machinery. Each production hall is tasked with a certain process of manufacturing, such as preparing material for assembling. From start to finish, everything happens at the production lines. Having an assembly line in the manufacturing process helps keep production processes regimented. This ensures the uniform production of items. It might be interesting to know that this company uses the latest computer-assisted robotic equipment in its production halls to get the job done. Automating processes help guarantee that each step is performed with uniform standards throughout. The other advantage is it allows quality control checks and implementation of standards to be performed with speed and accuracy. An integral part of this company is its research and development department. It is strategically intertwined with the production space. Products here are randomly pulled and tested at different stages. But that's not all. This advanced department also collaborates with foreign companies in research. Its production lines produce hundreds of home appliances each day. With this in mind, it has also provided hundreds of job opportunities. The company employs expert technical engineers and experienced workers to manage designs and machines. This company has a unique outlook toward the future and is continuously looking for more ways to foster growth opportunities. As part of its future vision, it hopes to expand its reach and gain a larger share in the international market by increasing its product portfolio. Like many in the manufacturing business, the US sanctions have caused some challenges for this company. But this firm was able to turn these challenges into major opportunities for growth. As you might know, local home appliance brands in this sector also compete with foreign ones. Iranian manufacturers produce the same quality of home appliances as their international competitors, yet many in the country still seem to be drawn to foreign names. It might be interesting to do a little price comparison here. Iran's culture and traditions play a big role in consumer trends. For example, newlyweds are expected to move into a home fully furnished with brand new items. The budget needed to furnish a home can cost upwards of $30,000 depending on the decision to purchase foreign brands.
However, the budget needed to purchase Iranian brands for ordinary items is far less. One would need a budget of around $10,000 to get it done. For example, the cost of an average two-door Iranian brand refrigerator is roughly $350. The same standard double-door refrigerator made by a Korean brand is roughly $2,500 when purchased in Iran. That is, of course, based on the daily exchange rate of 30,000 tumans to the dollar. In 2018, the government banned the import of foreign brands. Nevertheless, these brands were still seen in the domestic market. This was partly due to existing stockpiles of previous imports. The government implemented the initiative, aiming at strengthening domestic production and sales. But this gave rise to a lucrative black market of smuggled home appliances, which is still being regulated. Trafficked goods have been reduced in recent years. However, they still find their way into the domestic market.
Companies like the one we just mentioned are at the helm of this industry. Currently, there are some 80,000 home appliance manufacturing units in the country. Their domestic productions have not only helped satisfy local needs, but also saved the country millions on imports. Officials say the country is now self-sufficient in terms of the production of these items.
Iran's home appliance manufacturers were operating below their potential capacities around 2018. Before the ban on imports, some 85% of foreign brands available in the country were domestically produced under foreign licenses. The necessary infrastructure existed, but there was little domestic demand due to the competition with foreign brands. Based on figures from the Electrical, Metal and Home Appliance Office of the Ministry of Industry, Mining and Trade, the 2018 import ban was effective. Data from the office shows last year Iran produced over 15 million home appliance units. This is 3 million units more than the government's target of last year and double the production figure of 2018. Officials with the Ministry of Industry, Mining and Trade say indigenizing home appliance parts has reduced imports by $500 million. Such an increase in production also means that home appliance exports skyrocketed. Last year, $140 million worth of these items were exported, and the government hopes to push this figure to $200 million this year. Some industry participants argue one way to increase quality and expand Iran's home appliance market is by lifting the ban on imports. They say the industry has grown by leaps and bounds in recent years, adding it is capable of growing stronger through serious local and international competition. Others argue that it's too soon to lift the ban, as more steps need to be taken to strengthen domestic infrastructure for manufacturing home appliances.
Historically, universities were created to satisfy a thirst for knowledge. All over the world, rulers established knowledge academies for society to benefit from scholarly expertise generated in these institutions. And now, universities have an innate discovery. Their professors write leading research, and their scientific breakthroughs have revolutionized industries. Universities have contributed to health and medicine, which has sometimes literally stopped epidemics and saved lives. With this in mind, and universities would make for excellent...
Welcome to another edition of Supports the Development of... See why research is so important in the growth of industries. Stay with us as we uncover how the higher education system is contributing to the expansion of the national economy.
To get more insight on how universities support development of technology, we visited one in the capital city, Tehran.
Islamic Azad University, Northern Tehran Unit, has been around for decades. Each year, some 40,000 students matriculate in bachelor's, master's, and PhD programs. Academia shares the entrepreneurial drive for discovery and innovation. So, this university adopted a program for the development of technology and engineering, which is called the Roche Center. It is a growth center that manages and operates dozens of academic incubators. The program not only supports student innovation and entrepreneurship, but also provides services to knowledge-based companies for research and development. This platform receives support and oversight from the Ministry of Science, Research and Technology and the National Innovation Fund. The main goal in developing this program is to find technological solutions for various needs of the country. For example, the outcome of a research project conducted here was the formulation of a medicine used to treat COVID-19 infections. There are 40 core projects currently in incubation here, and the center has collaborations in many fields of the industry. It is able to stay present in innovative technology arenas by directly using academic research and potentials of its students.
Now, the advantage of growth programs such as the one we just mentioned is that it creates a network between students, research and knowledge-based firms. Most essentially, it joins the puzzle pieces of knowledge, tools and funds together needed for manufacturing innovative products. This helps create new and advanced products that might not exist in the market or need to be further developed for industries.
The center offers important facilities for scientific studies. It houses a large and highly equipped laboratory complex for advanced research. The lab provides services and equipment to 6 departments at the university, such as biochemistry and biology. The lab complex has many functions. One is to provide research facilities to students in master's and PhD programs in various sciences. Here, students who have graduated are also employed to conduct research brought in from outside knowledge-based companies. The other function of the lab is to provide a constructive link between university research and industries. For example, knowledge-based companies that produce pharmaceuticals can conduct their research and development at the highly equipped workshops. Research at this lab has helped companies produce many vital products that were previously imported. It might be interesting to know that researchers here adhere to strict national and international standards for product quality and safety. This is a critical step for startups or knowledge-based companies who want to commercialize products they have developed. This center was developed in response to the US sanctions. It has manufactured several products and advanced technology to satisfy the needs of Iranians during the period of sanctions. Some of these products are widely used in the medical sector.
Each university in the country has a growth program that supports the entrepreneurship and innovation of students and some businesses. These centers transform creativity and scientific research into products available in the market. In a nutshell, academic incubators are one of the tools used for economic growth. So, what is the government doing to strengthen research and expand the knowledge-based economy?
In 2016, Iran had 5 times more higher education centers than most developed countries in the world. At that time, there were some 2,640 higher education centers combined. By comparison, this number was just 40 units less than China, which is the most populous country in the world. That's all according to the Ministry of Science, Research and Technology. The ministry began implementing a nationwide plan to reorganize and aggregate higher education.